This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be here.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
We also still have our Jerusalem correspondent in studio today, Brent Nachtigall.
Hi.
And from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
The Trumpet.com's managing editor, Brad McDonald, had an outstanding Trumpet brief yesterday. It links the stunning turmoil hitting three nations in particular right now: America, Britain, and Israel. These three nations are closely linked in biblical prophecy, and we see them facing closely related crises. But as Mr. McDonald brings out, crisis implies things will return to normal after it blows over. But in these nations, normal has been, quote, irreparably broken. There is a war taking place over issues of law and government. It's provoked by people seeking to destroy precedent and tradition, and really, ultimately, biblical morality. And I really encourage you to read that article. It's up on thetrumpet.com today. It's a very good analysis, and it points back to some astounding quotes from our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, about this subject, providing prophetic context. The title of the article is America, Britain, and Israel, Seeing the Hope in Dysfunction. We're going to start by talking about the latest in Britain and America in particular, Britain with a constitutional calamity unfolding over Brexit, and America suddenly embroiled in an impeachment inquiry as Democrats decide they don't want to wait for the next election. They want Donald Trump out of office now. In Britain, the Supreme Court made a ruling that completely upends the rule of law. To learn about this, we'll turn to Richard.
Yes, it was just a stunning ruling from the Supreme Court on Tuesday. They have decided, basically, these 11 judges on the Supreme Court have put themselves as the highest authorities in the land. Even more so, you know, they've put themselves above the Queen. So Britain prorogued Parliament, or the Prime Minister, or the Prime Minister advised the Queen to promote prorogue Parliament. That means that Parliament takes a break. There's a few technical differences between that and a suspension, but basically, you know, it suspends, they go into recess. Because of Brexit, there were some people that didn't like this. They were afraid that this break would stop Parliament from frustrating Brexit. They wanted to frustrate Brexit, so they took this matter through the courts. They won in the High Court, with the highest law officers in the whole of the UK ruling, saying that this was fine. It was defeated, or so they lost in England. They won in Scotland, where Scotland ruled that the Prime Minister had suspended Parliament with improper motive, and so it went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled, they created a new law specifically for this case, putting a new limit on proroguing Parliament. They said that they basically said, no, prorogation didn't happen. We're going to completely undo the Queen's decision here. And it does, it goes against centuries of legal tradition, centuries of precedent. You know, it's in the Bill of Rights that an act in Parliament is not subject to oversight by the courts. The courts cannot reverse an act in Parliament. And they ruled, though, that that prorogation was not an act in Parliament, despite the fact it takes place in Parliament and is an act. So lots of legal creativity here to create this new position. And it means we're in a really strange position now, because it means we have this US-style Supreme Court now that decides they can step in and undo an act of the Queen. But we don't have the same kind of scrutiny and political oversight of the appointment of judges that you have in the US. Instead, now we just have a self-selecting body of judges with no scrutiny of what their opinions are, their capacity to do the jobs, etc. And they're the highest authorities in the land.
So maybe you could just talk a little bit more about the rationale that the court used to make this decision. And then I'd like to talk about just the I guess, more mundane ramifications of this. What was Boris Johnson trying to accomplish with the prorogation, and the fact that it is it has been nullified, what that means exactly, before we get into some of the larger ramifications?
Sure. So in terms of their rationale for their judgment, I mean, basically, law until now has just said that Parliament must provide laws, parliamentary approval is required for all taxes, and then Parliament each year must approve there being a standing army. So there's no limit to say when Parliament must be in session, when they can't be. They've just got practically a government has to bring Parliament pretty regularly to fulfill those things. But then what the Supreme Court did is they reasoned that Parliament is there to scrutinize the executive. Therefore, in order to do that, they can't be put on break for an excessive amount of time when there's an important issue for up for discussion. Therefore, we're creating this new law that limits how long they can be put on break for. Hmm. So some very creative legal thinking. I think the historian David Starkey put it best on a radio interview. He said, you know, not just with the Supreme Court overruling ruling, that Britain's constitution lies now smashed in pieces on the floor. I mean, this is just the latest in a series of acts where people have played fast and loose with the constitution, to put it mildly, because they want to frustrate Brexit. There was Speaker John Bercow, for example, saying, well, we're not going to be bound by precedent because we want to stop Brexit. Fundamental rules where legislation initiates, who controls the timetable of Parliament, who controls who debates what. You know, just those nuts and bolts of control and the Constitution have all been attacked and have been changed over Brexit. And there's a whole, I think it will take months before we get a full sense of the mess going forwards. But you've got this situation where the government, where you've kind of got this shadow government, because really the Parliament is controlling what would traditionally be the executive, but then they can't be called to account because system's not set up that way. It's just completely broken down. They've broken the constitution. Mm-hmm. And David Starkey said, well, it just can't be put back together. Melanie Phillips had an article. She said something similar, you know, so long, British constitution. It was nice knowing you. It's all over now. Others have pointed to how there's basically this new tyrannical layer in British politics with these judges with no political oversight. In terms of, and I think that's the real significance of this week.
Yeah.
And going forward, I think in terms of you asked about practical significance, and at this point, and it doesn't really seem much. They've just spent the last few days complaining about calling each other names and saying, "Well, you called me a turkey. You shouldn't have done that." I mean, they've accomplished nothing in the few days since they've been called back. It doesn't look like they're going to accomplish too much in the next couple of weeks. They got their surrender bill through Parliament before the prorogation hit anyway. So I don't think in terms of the practical fallout from this individual decision, there's going to be too much, but it's the long-term damage that it does to the Constitution that is most significant.
So the larger story that Mr. MacDonald was talking about this in his trumpet brief, and this is something that we've been following, we're going to be talking about what's happening in the United States here shortly, is essentially you see this class of elites who are willing to do anything. They're willing to throw the law to the wayside in order to accomplish what they believe is correct. They're ignoring centuries of precedent. They're ignoring the laws on the books, and they're demonstrating just how radical and how far-reaching their willingness to exert power in whatever means they can grab to accomplish what they think is correct.
Absolutely, and they're ignoring what they themselves have said. You know, many of these same people that are saying we must do anything we can to stop Brexit, just when they were last up for election, were telling voters, well, we disagreed with the outcome of the referendum, but we solemnly promised to uphold it. And what you're seeing is the same spirit in the United States and in the United Kingdom. You know, this spirit of telling those kind of lies. You see just so much. I don't think I can ever remember so many lies and hypocrisy in politics. I mean, just about all this week, we've seen people, including all of the Church of England bishops, piling on, accusing the Prime Minister of using dangerous language because he talks about the suicide bill. The surrender bill. And they say, well, using this term surrender, you're using toxic language and dangerous language. For 10 years, for pretty much the last decade, the Labour Party have been calling the Conservative Party murderers because mm-hmm. they oppose increases to welfare spending. Ever since the Brexit referendum, even before, we've heard Boris Johnson and co. being called fascists, Nazis, worse than Nazis, and not just by activists, by actual MPs, by senior members of the Labour Party. Mm-hmm. Yet all of a sudden, everybody turns against Prime Minister Boris Johnson, and not just, you know, the bishops, the BBC, the great and the good, all turning against the Prime Minister. And it's just like the US, where you have people have talked about this Trump derangement syndrome, where it just causes these people that you would have normally thought would be level-headed and, you know, say like some of these bishops and things like that, not fundamentally not political, but then they just all seem to go crazy. Yeah. You know, why this spirit of hypocrisy? Why this spirit of lies? And you see this common spirit behind the events in the United States, in the United Kingdom, and there's a spiritual reality there that's just critical to understand, because otherwise it's just almost incomprehensible what's happening here. And that explains why there's these similarities and really explains what's going on and what the real solutions are in both of these countries.
Well, you're getting a little bit ahead of us. We'll go ahead and transfer right into the second story here. The big story in America, Democrats in the House of Representatives launching a formal impeachment inquiry to try to get rid of President Donald Trump. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, well, Richard's definitely right. You see the same spirit of just lies and hypocrisy and innuendo, unverified rumor being put forward by news media if it was fact. Here in the United States, as you mentioned, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi launched a formal impeachment inquiry against President Trump on Tuesday. This is something that some of the left wing, the radical left wing in her party, has been pressuring her to do for a while. She finally got something that I guess she's able to use to throw them a bone. And so I've launched the inquiry. It's a big if as to whether it's going to do much, but it is, I think, the closest President Trump has come to possibly being impeached. And just kind of like recapping what the whole inquiry is about, there was a whistleblower who New York Times says was from CIA who came out giving a rumor he said he heard in the government that President Trump had pressured the Ukrainian president into trying to investigate Hunter Biden, the late Hunter Biden, the presidential candidate Joe Biden's son, for a corrupt business deal he did in Ukraine. The allegation being that a U.S. president pressuring a foreign intelligence agency to investigate a U.S. city is illegal, and that is true. There's still no evidence that President Trump did that. He's actually released his transcript of the phone call he had with the Ukrainian president, and it has not given any credence to what they've said against him. So I guess we'll have to wait for Nancy Pelosi's big impeachment inquiry to see if she has any other information on that topic. It is ironic, as several news sources have pointed out, that the charges specifically a sitting U.S. president pressuring a foreign government to investigate a U.S. citizen is illegal, because that's pretty much the Christopher Steele story in a nutshell. Mm-hmm. Obama's FBI cooperating with the Clinton campaign to wiretrap President Trump's campaign without a warrant. And then also, even a little closer to home, Joe Biden, when he was president, on this same
vice president.
Well, yeah, when he was vice president, on this same corruption probe with his son, had pretty much told the Ukrainian government that you're not going to get U.S. aid unless you fire this certain prosecutor who's looking into what my son's done. Andrew McCarthy did a piece for National Review entitled "Double Standards on Ukraine," where the last paragraph was pretty poignant. He says, "See the way the game is played? When the Obama administration leans on Ukraine for help in an investigation of political opponents, the Democrats and the media say, look how corrupt Paul Manafort was. when the Trump administration leans on Ukraine for help in an investigation of political opponents, the Democrats and the media say abuse of power, impeach him. Mm-hmm. And so that's just the hypocrisy angle of assuming the allegations against President Trump are true. Right mm-hmm. now, the evidence against him is a lot less
yeah.
than it is against the Obama administration.
So there've obviously been a lot of calls to go after the president for a long time, and Nancy Pelosi has held the line against this faction within the Democrat Party for quite some time. She finally gives in. Now we're into an inquiry that is apparently they want to make sure that this happens on an expeditious timetable to try to get this done as quickly as they can. And maybe you could just talk about what the ramifications of this would be going forward. What are the chances that this could actually result in the president's impeachment? And if it doesn't, then what happens at that point?
Right. And doing this on an expeditious timetable is probably a smart move for those who want to impeach the president, because I think the more and more you wait for more evidence to come out, the more you're going to lose your momentum. Because the Democrats won big in the House of Representatives last election, they do have the votes for this. There's 235 Democrats. I think they only need 218 to impeach the president. If you get like 93-94% of the entire party to agree that that's what they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
But the way impeachment works in the United States is the House impeaching the president is pretty much just wagging your finger in his face saying you did a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
It has no teeth unless the Senate comes in and issues a conviction. Constitutionally, a Senate conviction after an impeachment can remove a president from office. It's never happened in American history. Actually, impeachments has only happened twice. And the most recent time was when President Bill Clinton was impeached in the late 90s for lying under oath about an affair he had with an intern. But even that was similar, where the Republican House impeached him. The Senate didn't convict. He didn't leave office. And I think his approval ratings went up about 10% in the polls, because the American people thought the Republicans were, or a lot of independents thought the Republicans were being petty over the issue.
Mm-hmm.
They're definitely a number of political analysts, including at least part of Nancy Pelosi's mind, who's worried that that is going to happen this time, even if we either do the Democrats either attempt an impeachment, fail, and get egg on their face, or they attempt an impeachment, actually impeach him, the Senate doesn't do anything, the people think they're being petty for accusing Trump without much evidence of doing something that we actually have a lot of evidence President Obama did, and he wins the next election by an even bigger margin, because you've mobilized Republican voters who may, especially a lot of like the Midwestern voters who may stay home on election night, maybe figured like, oh, well, if they're going to impeach the president, maybe I should get out there and vote. So there's definitely a very realistic chance that this could backfire hard on the Democrats. But even if it does, it definitely increases the division in the nation and falls into what they are now calling the Kavanaugh asterisk theory, where you make accusations, whether they're true or not, as long as you can't conclusively prove them not true, you've got risk of civil disobedience in future, because you've got this, like I said, this asterisk hanging by your name.
Yeah, this article by Brad McDonald from yesterday that just pulls all of this together and shows the prophecy in Hosea 5 and verse 5 that links America, Britain, and the Jewish state of Israel together, that these nations are all going to fall together. It says that basically their fate within prophecy is linked. And he points back to a statement that Gerald Fleury made in America Under Attack that I thought was just outstanding. He talks about how in 1986, at the time that Herbert W. Armstrong died, Satan was cast down, and he immediately went after spiritual Israel, God's church. That was his first target. And this is referring to a prophecy in Revelation 12. But he didn't stop there. After that, he directed his attack against physical Israel. Who is that? Specifically, it is three of the modern nations that descended from the biblical nation of Israel, chiefly the United States, Britain, and the Jewish state. This is a big goal of the devil and his demons. They are out to bring Israel down, whether spiritual or physical Israel. What happened in that church shows you something of a blueprint for what Satan began to do in these nations. So as Richard was talking about earlier, this spiritual dimension to what's happening here, you see just the kind of hatred in the case of in both of these countries. In a sense, you can see that you could consider some of what they're doing strategically blundering, that it's not necessarily going to result in the effect that they hope to have, that it could actually backfire on them. But there's something that it's almost like they can't help themselves but to move forward. But to see these nations struggling the way that they are, these nations of Israel, as they're setting them, they set themselves up as a standard for the rest of the nations, the United States, the city on the hill that is meant to be an exemplar to the rest of the nations and an example of what a democratic and a free society can accomplish. To see it embroiled in this kind of political crisis, it shows there is something fundamentally wrong with man. There's something fundamentally wrong with people trying to govern other people. It's a lesson that we point back to quite a lot. And it's just interesting to see this taking place here just as we're entering just a couple of days before the Day of Trumpets, a festival that we in God's church celebrate every year in the fall. It's coming up on Monday, and that day pictures the return of Jesus Christ to this earth to take over from the governments of this world, to establish the kingdom of God on earth. And you just see the need for that demonstrated more and more all the time. It's just so obvious how inept human beings are at governing and how important it is that God set this right. And so there is quite a lot of hope and just excitement over these next couple of days as we begin to get our minds on all of these fantastic prophecies that are going to be unfolding in the time just ahead of us, the Day of Trumpets and on into the other holy days of the fall festival season. So there's a whole lot there to be excited about. In the meantime, we'll definitely keep our eyes on these situations. Read that article from Brad McDonald, America, Britain, and Israel, Seeing the Hope and Dysfunction. Stephen Fleury's been talking about the impeachment situation quite a bit on his Trumpet Daily Radio show, and stay tuned to thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much, Andrew and Richard, for those reports. We're going to move on now to Iran. Some very interesting developments on the Iran front. A recent attack on Saudi oil infrastructure seems to have shaken things up. We have a story about Europe's response and then one about what China is doing and even Russia. We're going to start with the news out of Europe. For this, we will turn to Brent Noctegal.
It was a surprising statement that was given on Monday by three nations of Europe, the United Kingdom, France, and also Germany. They released a joint statement which basically came out and blamed Iran for the attack that took place on September 14th against the Saudi Arabian oil infrastructure that again sent oil prices jumping 20%, the largest jump they've experienced in 30 years. It's back to normal right now, it seems. Saudi oil output is back to where it was before the attack. And so we've kind of got this restore to calm, at least in the oil markets, but not in terms of the capitals in Europe. They are worried about what happened. I think they were taken surprise by the degree to which Iran would strike at the heart of something that they're so concerned about, the oil output from the Middle East, particularly that from Saudi Arabia and the UAE, which they have interest in. This is a quote from their statement. It said this: "It is clear to us that Iran bears responsibility for this attack. There is no other plausible explanation." And so we have to look at Europe as being one of the greatest cheerleaders for Iran's resuscitation back into the international community through the nuclear deal. They have not jumped on board with President Trump coming out of the deal. They are still technically in the deal. But now they're saying that Iran was responsible for this attack. They've taken it too far. And we need to negotiate a better deal. This is what they said later on. Quoting now, more significantly, the European trio called for, quote, "Iran to accept negotiation on a long-term framework for its nuclear program." That's the nuclear deal, the former one, "as well as on issues related to regional security," which is what Trump was calling for, "including its missile program and other means of delivery." So in other words, Europe now wants to renegotiate the nuclear deal, just like President Trump has said and has done. And the editorial board at the Wall Street Journal said that this is basically now they want Trump's deal on Iran. So they're moving far closer to the United States position because of Iran's pushing the envelope right now with these aggressive actions.
So there's a couple of interesting aspects to this story, I guess. The first that immediately strikes you is just the fact that Europe has been so resistant to Donald Trump and belittled his efforts to isolate Iran and really taken quite significant steps to try to undermine what the United States has done. It seems that Iran's provocative acts have finally gotten the European leaders to the point where they find themselves fundamentally in agreement with the United States. There's a certain irony in that. I suppose that Donald Trump has to be kind of savoring this moment.
Oh, he would be, for sure, because this is what he said for 18 months, the reason why he pulled out of it, especially in terms of who's going to be affected most by Iran's actions in the region or stopping oil flows. It's not necessarily going to be the United States. It's going to be Europe. And that's what's interesting about this, just from that side, that point, is that these attacks themselves did really hit in an area where Europe would be affected. And it's like Europe was fine to be anti-Trump. Europe was fine to be anti-America and pro-nuclear deal when they weren't going to be specifically hurt by Iran's actions. And now that it looks like Iran isn't willing to protect Europe from the, let's say, the fallout of the Iran-US spat. They are on the firing line by the Iranians. Europe is taking their own defensive measures and coming across to the United States position. I do think it's also interesting that Iran isn't backing down either. That was on Monday when Europe came out with this statement. Then you had this litany of remarks from the Ayatollah saying how Europe is as bad as the United States, perhaps even worse. Germany, France, the UK, they need to be on the receiving end as well as the United States of what we're up to. And then Iran comes out on Wednesday and they write to the IAEA, the body that's basically overseeing the nuclear deal, and says, hey, guess what? We've started our advanced centrifuges spinning again, something that was banned from the nuclear deal, and we've done it already. And so it's like Europe comes out with this statement. Iran says, I don't care. Now we've got our nuclear ambition back, or at least we're putting into practice our nuclear ambition. Creating these centrifuges are a way of getting increasing the potency of uranium to the point that it can be used in a nuclear weapon, and the speed at which they can get there, it decreases the nuclear breakout time. So the nuclear deal put that back to a year. Now Iran says we've got our advanced centrifuges spinning again this week, bringing them closer to a bomb.
I'd like to just move on into a story that might explain part of Iran's willingness to defy this statement from Europe, and then maybe we can tie all of this back together, prophetically speaking. But if the United States and Europe are aligning on how to put pressure on Iran, it looks like China could undermine that pressure. For this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, China has agreed to make a $400 billion investment into the Iranian economy, mainly in the oil and gas sectors, which is Iran's, you know, the real lifeblood of their economy, but also touching on Iran's transportation, manufacturing, and infrastructure. So this agreement came after Iran's foreign minister visited China last month. And the deal is supposed to come over a 25-year period, so it's certainly not a lump sum that China's injecting into it. But if the proposed amounts were to continue for the proposed duration, then it would equal that colossal figure, $400 billion. So this is it's a huge windfall for Iran's economy. And in return, China would have the first right of refusal to take part in any and all projects in Iran related to petrochemicals. So anything like provision of technology or providing the personnel to build facilities for projects, China would have a great deal of control over all of that. So in some ways, these are not at all favorable terms for Iran. But because of what Brent just spoke about there, you know, the Iranians are feeling more and more isolated, especially with the Europeans finally acknowledging their culpability in some of these, you know, acts of terrorism. So they had little choice in a way. And for China, this has the potential to really boost its power in the Middle East, and not just to help the Chinese secure more of those hydrocarbons that their economy is so dependent on, but also to give China control over parts of the infrastructure in a really important kind of a crossroads or a hub part of the Middle East there. So that plays well into China's plan to use the Belt and Road Initiative to kind of connect the world to China.
So what's your sense of how much of a lifeline this may be throwing to Iran? There's no question but that the economic pressure the United States has been applying has been effective to some degree. And if Europe is coming on board with that as well, it seems that it would create additional problems for Iran. But here, if China is willing to say, you know, we'll make you our close partner, how much would that undermine it?
To a large degree, I believe, because, you know, this does come at a time when the U.S. is exerting maximum pressure on Iran. The U.S. wants to avoid war, but they still hope to find a way to change Iran's provocative behavior by using this strategy of so-called maximum pressure that basically uses sanctions to prevent the nations of the world from buying Iran's oil. So the plan is for those sanctions to eventually reduce Iran's oil exports down to zero. And this policy from the Trump administration, of course, is a 180-degree U-turn from the previous administration, the Obama administration, that actually wanted to use sanctions relief and relieved a lot of sanctions on Iran. But President Trump reversed that in hopes of, you know, convincing the Iranians, pressuring them to change their behavior. But then here comes China at a time when the sanctions are really biting, and China, you know, gives them this capital injection, this windfall of investment and cash that really, I think, takes the teeth off of those sanctions, or has the potential to.
There's so many interesting factors at play here. You know, just go back to what the European Union leaders have acknowledged, the fact that Iran was the actor behind this attack on Saudi oil infrastructure. It shows this intensification both of the tensions within the region between Iran and Saudi Arabia for dominance of that area, and also Iran's willingness to continue to extend its aggressive acts in order to show its control over oil infrastructure. This is something now that European leaders are acknowledging as fact. That they see this as something that is potentially very destructive to them going forward, considering how dependent on Middle East oil they are. The fact that China would look at that and say, and not see that as any kind of an obstacle to it doing business with Iran, you would think that that would, the fact that China would be doing this would, in some sense, create some tension, or at least put European leaders on edge about China's influence within the Middle East. There's just a whole lot of factors at play. And what's interesting is you overlay Bible prophecy over all of this and the roles of the King of the South, the King of the North, and the Kings of the East going forward in prophetic events. And you see all of the, you see the seeds of those future conflicts being not just sown, but watered and nourished.
Yeah, Bible prophecy indicates that there is going to be incredible interest in the Middle East from these major powers. Obviously, the King of the South is Iran and radical Islam there, and Europe is going to be the one that confronts them. So you can see that that's already brewing here with Europe's response. But also, after that, you see armies from the East taking the Middle East by storm, sending their troops over by the hundreds of millions. And why are they doing that? Perhaps there is, as Jeremiah says, some investment, some development of the transportation system. Maybe they're aware of how to get there, and they are interested in the in controlling the crossroads of the world after the King of the South is taken out. And so you have so many prophecies at play. But the fact, I think the overarching fact, that you see these international players very much becoming more interested and invested in the Middle East shows where the focus is, and Bible prophecy puts the focus there, obviously, as well. In terms of Iran's and Europe, the European clash, that's this one that's going to be a precursor to really the increased involvement from the kings of the East. People can read our trend article. It's entitled Iran and Europe Heading Towards a Clash of Civilizations.
Any further thoughts, Jeremiah?
Yes. Well, we talked about the King of the North, the Kings of the East, and the King of the South. And the fourth part of prophecy, the main pillar that we generally watch, is also the decline of the U.S. and the U.K. And really, that's also at play in this story, because China is buying this oil from Iran, not with dollars, which has been the standard currency for oil trade for, you know, the whole world for several decades. But instead, China is using its own currency, the yuan. And so if China had made this deal with dollar-based futures contracts, it would have run directly afoul of those U.S. sanctions. But instead, since China's conducting it with yuan, they can instead just kind of violate the spirit of those sanctions rather than violating them in letter. And so it is a step toward pushing international trade away from American dollars. And that's a trend that's been picking up speed in recent years, especially nations that really long for an end to the U.S.-dominated international system. Russia, China, Iran, Venezuela, they've all been looking for ways to bypass the dollar, especially in oil trade. Those are mostly, you know, excluding China, those are oil-exporting countries. And so they've longed for ways to bypass the dollar, but it's been difficult just because of the sheer size of the U.S. economy, the dominance of U.S. markets, and just the momentum of these long-standing international trade practices. But this new Chinese deal could be kind of a game changer and just show these nations and other parts of the world that the yuan is a viable alternative to the dollar.
Very interesting. And, you know, I can't help but think, too, just considering how much Iran has been increasing its terrorist activity and its aggressiveness in the region, just the fact that it would have this lifeline from China would enable it to continue to provoke other nations, including Europe. And exactly how that plays out or on what time frame might be uncertain, but the overall point in prophecy of how it is a Europe, an Iranian provocation that that sparks Europe to go on the attack, as it says in Daniel 11 verse 41, is unmistakable. So we'll continue to keep our eye on that. We thank you both very much for that. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we have news out of Egypt, whose president is in trouble. We track the movement of Carl Theodor Gutenberg and how Greta Thunberg is being exploited by climate change activists. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Egypt is a nation that factors heavily in end-time Bible prophecy, and demonstrations against Egypt's president this week are concerning and point to those prophecies. For this, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
So, obviously, the biggest protest took place 6 years ago with the ousting of Mubarak during the Arab Spring, the longtime strongman leader of Egypt. And then we had, coming into power after that, the Muslim Brotherhood, someone, a group that we've been looking to lead Egypt in terms of fulfilling its biblically prophesied role. So we're always looking for a return to Muslim Brotherhood rule or influence in Egypt. And yet for the past 6 years, we haven't really seen that since the arrival at the office of president of Fatah Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. He is a former general, and he has ruled with a strong arm. Mr. Trump calls him his favorite dictator. Basically, he rules by virtue of dominating the press, dominating the voting system. He is a dictator, but he holds back the radical Islamist elements in his society, just like Mubarak did until he was removed. And so for 6 years, you've had this fear factor involved in people coming out to protest his rule. Well, that fear factor is now gone. As of last Friday, thousands of people came out to protest against his rule. There was a man that has a YouTube channel over in Spain, and he's in exile, an Egyptian, that was posting these videos that were showcasing Sisi's building projects, saying that he's building palaces for himself and aggrandizing himself, enriching himself off the state. And the people rose up. And what's come out since is that the Muslim Brotherhood is still in existence in Egypt, and they were the ones that were perpetuating and let's say pushing this narrative that this Muhammad Ali is his name, that he was making on these videos. And so right now you have, as we speak, you have more protests taking place in Egypt. The last week there was 1,400 people that were arrested in such protests. And so this is a return to a protest movement where the people aren't as afraid to come out and protest against their president, for even though they might be arrested and such. And so there was a really important article that was written for the JCPA, they're a think tank operating out of Jerusalem. They wrote, "Is Egyptian President Sisi's regime in danger?" And it's basically looking at the Muslim Brotherhood's role in these protests. It says this: "President Sisi should be most concerned by the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood has come back to life. It still exists. The old guard is gone. Even those that were kind of middle-aged are gone. But it's the young crop now that have been influenced by Muslim Brotherhood ideology that are now taking to the streets. And they are being pushed and egged on by Al Jazeera, who loves the Muslim Brotherhood, by Turkey, that loves the Muslim Brotherhood. And so stories coming out this morning are that these protests are absolutely massive. And you'll read that on Al Jazeera because they want to promote these protests. And so it's hard to get the facts out. But one fact we can rely on is that Muslim Brotherhood is back in Egypt, and they are pushing for popular protests against this president as they did the last one.
So Bible prophecy tells us why this is significant.
Yeah, we expect Iran and the King of the South to actually ally with Egypt, which most people don't expect that to ever happen, given one Sunni and one Shia. And yet, we know that it is going to take place based on Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40 to 43. It talks about Egypt being part of this alliance that really does give Iran a lot of power. And so we are expecting that to take place at some point. And when we see the Muslim Brotherhood rising like this, we do expect eventually their return to power.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Brent. A new cooperation plan between the defense ministries of Russia and China this week. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu held a meeting this week with his Chinese counterpart, Wei Fonga. And the two announced at the end of the meeting that they've drafted a cooperation agreement for the Russian and Chinese defense ministries, which will come into effect in 2020. So at this meeting, the two sides also discussed the Center 2019 military drills that just concluded. That was a massive set of war games, and both Russia and China sent huge numbers of soldiers to take part. So a lot of the meeting was looking back on those exercises and reviewing what went well and what could have gone better. But then they also looked forward to a future when Russia and China are cooperating even more closely, and when their militaries are even more tightly integrated. And that's why they hammered out this new cooperation deal. So it is a military technical deal that they're forging. It means they'll continue to drill together. They'll continue to hold high-level summits to just further integrate their militaries. And the details of it haven't been made public yet, but it looks like this will just add another heavy bead to the weld that is bonding Russia and China together so much at present. We see this in politics, we see it in economics, and most significantly, we see it in military matters, such as this deal here shows. And we have a detailed article on our website called Why the Trumpet Watches, Russia Allying with China. And one quote from that article says, "For over half a century, The Trumpet and our predecessor magazine, The Plain Truth, have been expecting Russia and China to partner up. We've expected it because Bible prophecy says that in the time of the end, the Russia-China axis will lead an Asian military bloc that will play a central role in World War III." And then it says, "The fact that the Russia-China axis has now suddenly arrived means the fulfillment of these Bible prophecies is astonishingly clear." So this article examines numerous scriptural passages just to prove that the Bible did prophesy of this Russia-China axis thousands of years before it happened. Passages like Revelation 9:16 and Ezekiel 38 are examined really thoroughly in this, and it explains that this axis will play a key role in nuclear World War III and those events that lead up to the return of Jesus Christ. So when we see these two nations drawing close, such as with this deal that was just announced this week, we should really see that as setting the stage for the next and final world war. So we'll include a link to that article in the show notes there.
Yeah, I do hope people will read that, because we see headlines like this so often that it's just easy to forget just how remarkable it is to see these two nations coming together the way that they are, given the animosity that they've had toward one another in the past. That article on our trends section on our website points all of that out and shows Herbert W. Armstrong was talking about this long before there was any kind of reconciliation between these two countries based on the prophecies of the Bible and the coming together of these great Asian giants. It really is one of the most compelling stories of why biblical prophecy is so important to keep your eye on in watching world events and showing the vindication of prophecy. So we do appreciate you bringing that to us, and we'll put a link to that, as Jeremiah said, Why the Trumpet Watches, Russia Allying with China. Thank you for that. The leadership void in Germany is quite stark, and one man we're tracking as likely to fill that void has made some headlines recently. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, former German Defense Minister Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg is back in Germany. He was the German Defense Minister. He was kind of kicked out in disgrace almost 10 years ago now. I think it was back in something like 2011. He left Germany. He was living in the United States. It's now confirmed that he's moved back to Germany. There have been kind of rumors of him moving back ever since the beginning of the year, but just this week, Die Welt had a headline titled "The Baron is Planning His Return," and they quoted him saying, "My wife and children wanted to return to Germany after being in the U.S. for almost 8 years." So he's back, and I think there's a couple of interesting things about this. Like you said, Germany has this political crisis, this slow-rolling political crisis, this vacuum at the top of politics. Angela Merkel is kind of past her best before end-of date. Her chosen successor has proven to be a big flop. And so everyone is still like, well, you know, who's going to save us from these crises? Who is going to be the next strong leader? We don't know. And into all of this comes in this person that we for years have been saying, you know, watch this guy. We think he could be the strong leader that's coming to Germany. So the fact that he's coming back now is interesting. And the second thing is just the attention that his return has gathered. You know, imagine, I don't know, maybe Andrew knows the name of some politician that was kicked out of Mr. Obama's government back in 2011 and hasn't been really involved in politics since. It's kind of surprising that the media would even pay attention to a has-been like that. But they pay attention to zu Guttenberg. They sat one had a headline, "Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg is back!" He was invited to a conference of the 100 most important people with Bildfest. And Bild had an article. This is Germany's best-selling tabloid. "For a long time, it was quiet around Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg, but now he dares to return to step in the spotlight," he said. And he's been also visiting Austria and making appointments over there. So there's still a lot of interest around this individual as well. The German press don't see him as a has-been. And so they're still very interested in what he's doing. Now, the reason why we're watching is there are some critical prophecies in the Bible that talk about a strong man coming out of Germany. Daniel chapter 11 talks about that. Daniel chapter 8 especially talks about a strong leader that gets to power in Germany and really ends up leading all of Europe. And there's a whole load of reasons why we're watching Mr. Zu Gutenberg and think he could be that strong leader. He kind of fits all the clues that we have to what he'll look like. He has connections to, or he's a kind of a successor of the German politician, former German defense minister, Franz Josef Strauss, that Herbert W. Armstrong pointed to. So we've been watching for this guy for a long time. Now he's back. And if you want to know more, though, about what the Bible says and why specifically we're watching this guy, because that's just a really brief overview, we have a free booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent. So please, you know, if you're interested in it, get that booklet and you can prove to yourself why the Bible says there's a strong leader coming. And we explain in that booklet why we think Mr. Zu Gutenberg could be that strong leader.
Fantastic. We also have an article by Josue Michels that went up this week. K.T. Zu Gutenberg returns to Germany. And incidentally, Josue is our on-staff German, native German. And so he's watching what's happening in Germany very closely. And I did use him on Wednesday's Trumpet Hour as the voice of Friedrich Nietzsche. So you need to go, listen to Wednesday's Trumpet Hour to get that that German accent that only Josue can provide for us. Thanks for that, Richard. We're going to finish the program with a story about a 16-year-old girl who is lecturing the world about how it is destroying her dreams. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, there's a rising trend, especially here in America, is just child activists, or specifically adults using child activists to push their to push an agenda. The biggest high-profile one is Greta Thunberg, who is a 16-year-old Swedish climate activist who took a zero-carbon ocean voyage across the Atlantic to America to lecture Congress last week on the need to adopt Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal as fast as possible, and then took to the United Nations building in New York City at this Monday to lecture representatives from around the world about how they have stolen her childhood with their empty words and are facilitating the next mass extinction because of their continued reliance on fossil fuels. There's going to be a bit too much for me to unpack in the time we have left today about the science of climate change. But when you watch this clip of this 16-year-old just dripping with like bitterness and vitriol against the adults in her life who are apparently deliberately destroying the environment, it does remind you a lot of the other child activists we've seen in the United States. Yeah, it reminds you of Emma Gonzalez, who was a student after the Stoneburg mass shootings in Florida some months back, who gave a similar speech condemning any politician who hasn't taken action to shut down the NRA as having blood on their hands. And you had massive walkouts from classrooms across the nations by teenagers telling their government representatives that they're basically accusing their politicians of murder and destroying the planet because of the rules in the books on gun control and environmental legislation and things that are just, they've way oversimplified the complex issues that have no understanding about. And it does bring to mind about the prophecy in Isaiah 3, specifically verses 4 through 5. Where God even says of end time Israel, says, I will give children to be their princes and babes shall rule over them. The people shall be oppressed by one by another, and everyone by his neighbor. The child shall behave himself proudly against the ancient, and the base against the honorable. You definitely see that with the Greta Thunberg clip about a child behaving them proudly against people who've made their life leading nations. Mm-hmm. Not saying that all their policies are perfect or even that good in some cases, but people who know a lot more about these issues than she does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I definitely would like to talk more about this. Maybe we can save this for next Wednesday's Trumpet Hour. So maybe you can tune in to next Wednesday and you can hear more about what Andrew has to say about that. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. We would like to invite you to email your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Georgia O'Keeffe. Nobody sees a flower, really. It is so small, it takes time. We haven't time. To see takes time. Like to have a friend takes time. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.